So today is February 24th. My name is Kay Dunaway, and I'm interviewing Bev Burr in Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So to start out, can you tell me when and where you were born?
When and where I was born? I was born in the hospital in Clintonville, Wisconsin, in May 22nd, 1953. So I grew up, my parents were actually from, my family was from Marion, Wisconsin, but the closest hospital was Clintonville.
Gotcha. Did you have any siblings?
Yeah, I already had, when I was born, I already had an older sister, an older brother, and then I also have a younger sister.
Lovely. What did your parents do for a living?
Well, a lot of different things over the years. My dad and mom met during World War II, so my dad had been in the military, and he stayed in the military for a while after World War II, and then he came back to Marion. Marion was his hometown. And then I know he worked as a manager of a hotel in Clintonville, and he also worked at the four-wheel drive factory. And he also he was unemployed a lot now and then over the years when the factory didn't have work. He also started his own real estate insurance business. And then he worked as, last 10 years of his working career, he worked as a rural letter carrier. And then my mother was, when I was small, was mostly a stay-at-home mom. She also, though, did a lot of sewing for people, made curtains, and then later, when I was a little bit older, she had a bachelor's degree in home economics, and so she got a job teaching in Bowler, Wisconsin, which is a ways from Marion. So she commuted there and taught there for, I don't know, I think like 8 or 10 years before she retired.
That's interesting. So it sounds like both of your parents did a lot of different things.
Yeah.
What exactly did your dad do in the military?
You know, he was in the Signal Corps. He, you know, he was drafted into World War II, and he was sent to Hawaii. This was, you know, after Hawaii had been bombed, and so, you know, he never would talk much about what he did. I don't believe that he was in any direct combat situations. I think it was more like trying to figure out what the enemy was doing. I don't know. You know, it seemed like he was sworn to secrecy or something. Because whenever I asked him about it, he would never tell me anything.
How did his being drafted affect the rest of the family? Did your mom have to?
Well, this was he met my mom during the war, so
okay,
he
that's right.
Went. He was stationed in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, for kind of his training. You know, before he went to Hawaii, so he was on leave, and so he met my mother. My mother's family's from Mississippi and Gulfport, Mississippi in particular. So he met my mother while he was on leave, and then he corresponded with her for a couple of years during the war. And my mother corresponded with more people than just my father. But he came back, and he really wanted to marry her, and you know, so they got married pretty quickly after he got back from the war. So how it affected my family was that then he got stationed in the Washington, D.C. area. So he lived there for a couple of years. That's when my older sister was born.
So, what about you when you were a kid? What did you like to do? What were your interests?
Oh, boy, yeah. Well, I was kind of they used to call me a tomboy. I loved playing sports, and I loved being outside, and we lived in a small town, and there were places, you didn't have to go very far, and you could kind of be out in the woods, or there was this area that I loved to play. There was a little creek that went through town, and then there were all these huge granite boulders, And I used to like climbing on them, and I used to like playing in the creek, but don't tell my parents, I wasn't supposed to. They usually could tell when I came back with wet shoes or something. But and I loved riding my bike. I went all over the town on my bike, and like right across the street from our house was cornfields, and they were growing, they often grew sweet corn, so I would go into the cornfields and eat raw sweet corn. I even tried making fires to try to cook it a little bit in the middle of the field. So I played, you know, with all the kids in the neighborhood. Like I say, we played softball and football and or baseball and football. I guess more it was more baseball than softball back then. And then, you know, we used to do circuses. You know, we used to sell lemonade, all kinds of things like that.
That sounds fun. Being a kid is it's so free.
It was pretty fun. Well, and back then, you know, like our parents, you know, they didn't have to watch us so close.
You know? It's different now. Nowadays, people are very protective and such. Even the difference, mm-hmm. like when I was a kid, my parents didn't watch me all that much. But now, what I see.
Yeah.
These days, it's very different.
Yeah, it's very different. A big thing that really influenced me as a child was my older brother had developmental and physical disabilities because he had brain damage from his birth. And so he, had some disabilities. And so I kind of was supposed to, even though he was older than me, I kind of watched out for him a lot. So mm-hmm. sometimes we would run away from bullies a lot. Mm-hmm. I remember that, too. So it wasn't all fun and games. But
how do you think that shaped you growing up? You know, do you feel like maybe you had more responsibility as a kid than?
Yeah, I think it gave me more responsibility as a kid. And to this day, I'm my brother's. My parents picked me to be my brother's guardian. And so I'm currently his guardian. So I've been watching out for my brother for all these years, you know, most of my life. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's made me someone who takes responsibility, you know. I guess that's all I'll say about that.
Do you think that perhaps it, you, as a small child, taking care of other people led you to what you did later in life, which was... You know, and
yeah,
take care
I think
of
so. I mean,
well.
I think, yeah, I think I have a strong, I value service to others, you know, both in, after I was in grad school and had been a TA in women's studies, I was hired by the Madison Fire Department. So I worked there for 20 years, and I loved the, you know, having a job where my job was to help people. Mm-hmm. You know,
what was it like to be a firefighter?
Well, at that time, it was extremely controversial.
Yeah.
When I was hired, and
were you the first woman in Madison to?
I wasn't the first woman in Madison, but I was in the first class of women who actually made it to the fire stations. In 1978, there were two women who had been hired by the fire department, but they were fired during training. And then they filed a suit against the city, and as part of their suit, they were allowed to join the class that I was in 1980. So the class I was in, there were about 10 women who graduated from that class and actually went into the fire station. So you could say we integrated the fire station with women.
What kind of things did you deal with as far as the controversy, you know, what...
Well, there was a lot of media attention, mm-hmm. you know. There were reporters out at our training facility, you know, watching what was going on. There was lots of articles in the newspaper, and there was a lot of resistance, I would say, from the firefighters' union.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of support from the chief of the fire department, Ed Durkin, who had been the president of the union mm-hmm. prior to becoming fire chief. And he was extremely supportive of women firefighters. And also, in fact, in our class in 1980, there were also many, so all the women in the class were white women, but all the there was also a significant number of men of color in our class. And I might add there was a significant number of relatives of white men on the job. Mm-hmm. So Ed was really good at the politics of things. He knew that for the women to be successful, you needed to hire more than one or two women.
Right.
You know, and same for the men of color. But he also was trying to appease some of the people in the fire department who'd been waiting for years for their sons to get on, or
gotcha.
Their nephews.
Yeah.
So he hired them too. So there was a, you know, a lot of scrutiny,
mm-hmm.
I would say. And then what we struggled with during the training was that, you know, we felt we were getting scrutinized, we weren't getting graded as high. Almost every evaluation I got, you know, I completed the task, but they would, the people evaluating us, the trainers would say things like lacks upper body strength. They would like add that on to every description of what we did,
uh-huh.
Practically. And, you know, and so the chief kind of saw that we weren't getting as good of marks, you know, we weren't
right.
doing that well. But when he would come out and watch us and thought we were doing fine,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then, so then what he had the training staff do was sit down and come up with some kind of final exam, like a physical final exam that everyone would take, the
mm-hmm.
same exam, and lay out ahead of time how you were going to grade it. So they sat down and they came up with a test based on some fire that happened once and what one guy had to do all by himself
mm-hmm.
that particular day. You know, so they strung together a series of like physical tasks that were fairly challenging, and you had to do one right after another. And so interestingly enough, you know, I don't remember exactly. I think there might have been one woman who failed it. There was one man who also almost failed it, or at least I observed him losing control
mm-hmm.
of the hose line during the test, you know. But the rest of us all passed, and so we were allowed to graduate and go into the stations. So, and then for years after that, because people were always complaining about, oh, the women aren't strong enough and all this kind of stuff,
mm-hmm.
They made all the firefighters take that same test every year. And it you know, and people sometimes, it was mostly older men
mm-hmm.
who couldn't pass the test. One man, in fact, even had to be resuscitated after the test.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, years later, they had a consultant come in and develop a test, you know, like that. But yeah, it was all new. You know, it's like, well, you know, like we had to do, I can't remember how many push-ups. The physical exam we had to take just to get on the job was kind of more of a fitness test
mm-hmm.
and a test of your balance and whether or not you're afraid of heights,
mm-hmm.
you know. But there were concerns that a test like that wouldn't hold up in court because it wasn't related to actual job
right.
skills, you
mm-hmm.
know. So the test, you know, they developed for us was like raising, you know, the biggest ladder that you're supposed to be able to raise by yourself, and then carrying a roof ladder up, you know, to a three-story building or something, putting it on the roof, taking it down, carrying it down, and then we had a dummy that we had to carry down a ladder,
mm-hmm.
190-pound dummy or something like that, and everybody had to be able to carry that
yeah, wow.
fake body down the ladder by themselves. So, yeah, we learned, it was, you know, Ed Durkin was right, you know, it really helped having other women there, and it also really helped us having some of the men of color were very supportive of the women, too.
Mm-hmm.
They totally got the discrimination that was going on. And so, for example, when they pull out the heaviest ladder and they, and you know, and two women go to, you know, maybe it's a four-person ladder raise or something like that, and if, you know, two women step forward to go do it, then most of the guys would just hang back, and so the only other people that would go out there would usually be the black men or the,
yeah.
or the other women, mm-hmm. You know, so things like that happened, you know, and then when we got into the fire stations, you know, there was a big issue back then about, there was a lot of pornography in the stations, in the bathrooms, and so one of the jobs, when you're a rookie firefighter, is you clean the bathrooms.
Oh.
You know, so you got to...
Lovely.
You got, it almost seemed like some of these were getting set up for us to see. Certain pages were open. Or maybe they were leaving them for each other. I don't know. But anyway, it's, mm-hmm. it you know, and a lot of us, well, you know, I had come right from women's studies.
Right.
You know, into the fire station, and there were several of us that were feminists, and you know, so we didn't think that stuff should be there,
mm-hmm.
you know. And anyway, so there was a lot of controversy around that. And, you know, sometimes I would find little, you know, someone would slip a magazine or a book under my pillow or something like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, after I'd, you know, made your bed during the day. And I don't know. I got kissed once when I was asleep at the station. That woke me up, of course.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, you really didn't, I don't know, it was just, you didn't, you were trying to get along.
Right.
You know.
Right, so you didn't.
And so I didn't tell anybody about it. You know, no one else knew besides just, I knew who it was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew to steer clear of him. you know, so, and really, we also got connected with women all over the country. You know, who, because this was a time that a lot of fire departments were starting to hire women, and there were a lot worse things went on in other cities compared to Madison, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So how did you get connected to women in other places? Like,
well, yeah, there was a group of women organized a newsletter. Mm-hmm. I can't even remember what the name of it was. I gave all my copies away to be auctioned off, because I had saved every one, but for a fundraiser. So I think it was Women in Fire was the name of the newsletter. You know, so then, you know, people wrote articles, and it just went out in the mail, and, you know, so we got to read about other people's stories, and then eventually we started having annual conferences and things like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it was a way we could support each other, and we could share information on, you know, everything going back to our training, you know, like the guys would show us how to do something, or that our trainers would show us how to do a certain thing, but that might not work for the woman who was, you know, 5'4",
right,
you know,
right.
And that might not work for somebody who, you know, didn't weigh 200 pounds or, you know,
mm-hmm.
things like that. And then the equipment we had was like, it was men's equipment, and that didn't bother me too much because I had pretty big hands and pretty big feet, so my gear fit pretty well. But some of the smaller women with smaller hands really had a lot of trouble with the gloves,
mm-hmm.
and being able to get a good grip to do things like raise ladders and stuff like that, you know. So we figured out alternative techniques and taught them to each other, you know, so that, you know, like every time you got to do something new, you didn't know how heavy it was going to be, or, you know, it was always a little bit nerve-wracking, you know, you're going to, here you're going to raise this huge ladder and, you know, and do physical skills you've never done before, and, you know, and so maybe we might not do it, able to do it the first time or second time or something like that, but then as different ones of us would start to catch on to it, then we'd share with each other how we did it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you just get your hips a little closer, you get more leverage, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, so.
Wow, that's really amazing that you were able to come together for annual conferences, and
mm-hmm.
that's just a really cool
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, that didn't happen until, you know, later on, maybe 5, 10 years down the road?
So around like 85, 90.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm just guessing at that. This is pretty long ago now.
Yeah. All right, what about, can you tell me a little bit about your time that you spent at the university at UW-Madison?
Sure. Well, I got an undergrad degree here. I came here as an undergrad, and my idea was I'd be pre-med. And I started out taking pre-med classes. Quickly realized that I was kind of like, I'd come from a small town. I'd spent my senior year in Germany as an exchange student, so I'd missed a lot of my senior classes in high school. And so I kind of was struggling a little bit. And also being a woman from a small town and having my classes, the pre-med classes, were mostly men in my classes. There weren't too many women going to med school back then.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty small percentage. And I was kind of intimidated by a lot of my classmates and frankly by a lot of my professors. So, and it was my first opportunity to play organized sports. And so I went over to Lathrop Hall because I wanted to play basketball really bad. I'd never ever played on a team. I just played a couple pickup games. And had it in gym class in high school. And the woman asked me, do you want to be on the intramural team or the extramural team? I didn't know what she was talking about, so I just said, doesn't matter, either one. And she says, you're kind of tall. I think I'll put you on the extramural. You can go meet the coach and go to the practices. So, and I started my first basketball game as a freshman on the UW women's basketball team. Now, back then it was a club sport, you know, so we just played other state schools. But then by the time I was a senior, that's when Title IX happened, and then we became part of the athletic department. So while I was at UW, I also was on the track team a couple years, and I played volleyball all four years. And I didn't know how to play volleyball when I came. But again, I was big, I could jump, I was strong, I was pretty coordinated, so I learned how to play. And by my sophomore year, I started on the volleyball team. So, and sports quickly became more important to me than academics. And that's really what got me through college, was just knowing that I still had eligibility to play sports. So. So I ended up...
So that was your big motivator.
Yeah. So I ended up kind of backing away from my pre-med plan, you know, and I think a lot of that did have to do with the times and being intimidated, you know, like I say, by my male professors and...
Were there any female professors at the time that you remember?
You know, no female professors in most of my classes. Just, I did have a... sometimes I would get a woman TA.
Mm-hmm.
I had a woman TA that really actually gave me a lot of encouragement and, you know, but I had trouble getting, you know, A's and everything. Back then, you pretty much had to get A's and everything to get into med school. And,
right.
And you had to, you had to get recommendations from important people. I didn't know any important people. I was too nervous to even talk to my professors, so they didn't know me either, you know. So that was part of being kind of shy and, you know,
so then what led you to the women's studies?
Well, then I worked, well, so I got a degree in medical microbiology. I got a job in town at a lab, and I continued to play amateur volleyball and basketball. And then I decided I needed to go to grad school. I wanted to become a coach. And so then I applied to the men's physical education program because they... Back then, the women's and the men's physical education was separated. And so you could learn dance if you went to the women's physical education program, and then you could learn exercise physiology if you went to the men's physical education program. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to become a coach. So I was in grad school there. And after my first year of grad school, I was working... was called the biodynamics lab. I got a, an RA position, you know, that really helped with a stipend and paying my tuition and stuff. But I was having some run-ins with people there, and one example was one of my colleagues was showing, doing a slideshow with his research, and of course he was using pictures of women in bikinis,
mm-hmm.
you know, to make jokes or points about his, you know, this is one of my top subjects in my research, you know, those, mm-hmm. that kind of joking and stuff like that, and of course I knew that was wrong. So I complained about it, and then all of a sudden, you know, not everybody, but a lot of the people that had been nice to me just kind of ignored me after that. So I felt pretty isolated. About that time, I started playing rugby. There was a women's club team, and that was one of the first women's rugby teams in the country, I think. And this would have been in the late 70s. And then I met Mary Omni Watley. And then later when she was, so I'd met her actually before, maybe even before this grad school thing. I don't remember how the timing worked. But in any event, because I was working on a master's degree, she said, you know, you could apply to be a TA in women's studies. And so I did. And then I got to be 1978. Mary Omni had created a new class called Women and Their Bodies in Health and Disease. And so I got to TA that with another gal, Chris. I can't think of her last name right now. Anyway, so we were the first TAs for that, and that was a fabulous experience because Mary Omni spent a lot of time basically teaching us how to be TAs, and then she also gave me the opportunity. I lectured a few times, so like I lectured about exercise physiology because that's what I was studying. Also, I was very interested because I was thinking about this fire department thing.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading about it in the papers. That was 1978 when those first two women were hired, and I actually knew one of the women. I'd been on the track team with her. And so I was really curious about physical differences between men and women. So even though that wasn't the topic of my master's thesis, it was real different how you got information back then. You had to kind of order it, and then you'd get copies of articles,
mm-hmm.
Research articles. But I started ordering articles related to any studies that had been done related to comparing the physical differences between men and women so that I really understood. You know, I really wanted to understand, you know, and there wasn't much research, you know.
Right.
But I felt I actually learned some interesting things that actually helped getting on the fire department and helped in advising and encouraging other women to get on the fire department. So, and I'd even like, you know, some of that I'd bring into the lecture that I did on exercise physiology, too. So.
That's really neat that you got that opportunity to lecture.
Yeah, that was great. That was great. And Mary Omni was a great mentor. And the lectures were great. I mean, I was like, I learned a lot from listening to her lectures, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it was challenging and fun to learn how to be a TA, how to lead discussions and things like that, and how to grade papers. And, you know, she was very good at teaching us how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So
did you spend a fair amount of time at the Brook Street House?
Yep. There were regular meetings, you know, and we just hang out there. It was really comfy. I remember there being really comfy sofas and stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just a nice place to go hang out.
So did you participated in the a lot of the meetings that they...
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't a big participator.
Mm-hmm.
I was mostly a listener, and I was mostly in awe
mm-hmm.
of all these other women who, professors that knew so much, you know. And then I remember participating, actually getting to hear candidates, people who they were going to hire,
uh-huh.
of getting to hear them come in and
mm-hmm.
give talks,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it was just very expanding for me.
Do you remember some of the key issues or debates that went on in that house?
Boy, I'd have to think about it a little bit.
What's your most vivid memory from that house? You know, perhaps like a piece of artwork or.
You know, it's pretty vague what I remember.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like sitting in a couch, you know, and being in a room with a lot of women who were like extremely bright
mm-hmm.
and articulate, and I think more of it was much more about feminism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't about I mean, it was also very gay and lesbian friendly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we weren't talking about, gender, more in-depth gender issues. And we weren't talking about race so much,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the intersectionality of oppressions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe some people were, but I wasn't getting that, you know. It was really strongly feminist,
mm-hmm.
you know, and framing things from a feminist perspective. So.
Were you involved in any feminist protests or political activism outside of the university at that time?
At that time, not so much. I think for me, it was more, I saw myself, you know, getting on the fire department, being on athletic teams as being a pioneer myself.
Mm-hmm.
If that isn't too super egotistical. I was doing it. I was showing people that women could do these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that kind of was my way of being an activist.
Yeah.
You know.
That's really cool. So. I played sports when I was a little kid. And
uh-huh.
I actually played ice hockey with the boys until I was like 14. And then I played girls hockey for a while. And so I was always the only girl on the team.
Yeah,
and
Well, that's pretty much in my neighborhood growing up. I was the only girl that was playing after a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then my mother took me aside and told me I had to stop playing tackle football with the high school boys. You know, but I was glad I got to do as much as I did. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, in many ways I was glad. You see, I was, you know, I knew I was a little bit different. I didn't exactly understand about being a lesbian. When I was in high school, I didn't have the vocabulary. Nobody knew what, no one was talking about
mm-hmm.
it. I had never even heard the word homosexual or lesbian. And, I didn't read The Well of Loneliness or any of those kind of books until I went to college. That's when I started reading books like Our Bodies Ourselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, had a chapter or something about it. And oh my gosh, I kept reading it over and over and over again, you know. There was such a hunger for information,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was hungry for it. And but I was really glad I didn't have to deal with that in high school.
Yeah.
You know, because if I would have known I was a lesbian in this little tiny town, I wouldn't have had anybody to talk to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been pretty tough, I think.
Yeah.
So I just thought of myself as, well, I'm just not interested in boys.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm going to be a nun, you know?
So you said that the house was actually really welcoming to lesbian and gay people.
I felt very welcome there. I'm sure I was out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And by that time, I was out to myself. So, yeah, I was out
mm-hmm.
in that environment.
I know that the neighborhood that the house was situated in was
mm-hmm.
surrounded by some other, like, gay organizations, like, I can't think off the top of my head, but there was some, like, gay men's groups that were
around
the area. Did you guys ever...
You know, I wasn't even aware of that. I knew there was, like, a child care center there.
Yeah,
and again,
yeah.
that kind of related to feminism. You know, all those child care centers started springing up, you
mm-hmm.
know, so that women could go to work, you know.
Right.
That kind of thing. So, you know, that was kind of a new thing. I remember Bernie's or something was called, I think. could be wrong about that. But it was like kind of right around the back or something up from the house, Brook Street house. So, yeah, I felt very welcome there. The comparison, it allowed me to finish grad school, even though I was in the men's physical education department. I was hanging out at women's studies all the time.
Gotcha.
Because that's where I was getting my support.
What did you end up doing your master's thesis on?
I did a small study with human subjects on running, and what happens when you start a running. Try to remember my hypothesis. I really wanted to do the study on women, but I couldn't get any money to do the study on women. Mm-hmm. I could get a little money to do the study on men. And so the cardiologist I was working with said, well, it might be the same mechanism in men as it is in women. But the question came up that many women athletes, especially those who did a lot of distance running, were becoming anemic. And just some of them, and some of them pretty severely. And we were trying to figure out why. And so one of the theories was that from the actual pounding of running, the idea of running and running long distances for women was completely new at that time. You know, I do believe me and my friends were the first joggers in Madison back in the early 70s. So the theory we had was that it was the same thing. It had been recorded among soldiers when they go on a 20-mile march in a day. The next few days, a lot of the men would have red urine. It's because they had broken down so many red blood cells that their body wasn't able to capture the hemoglobin. So it was coming out in their urine. And our theory was that this was happening, that this happens in certain impact sports, but it happens on a much smaller scale. And what we found out was something kind of interesting, and again, this was just a pilot study, but what we did find out is that there was a certain protein in the blood, and it was probably something, nowadays we didn't know all this, but my guess is, looking back, that it was probably something that, you know, you got the gene for it, you get more of it or less of it. So some people had high levels of this protein called haptoglobin, and some people had lower levels. And the ones that had the lower levels had more hemoglobin in their blood, in their urine. You know, you couldn't see it. They weren't peeing red, but microscopically they were losing hemoglobin at a higher rate than those that had higher levels of haptoglobin. So it kind of, you know, confirmed what we were thinking that there was. So I made a bunch of guys go running in cheap tennis shoes. And I'd go running with them. But some of them weren't very athletic. It was really hard to get in. Like I wanted them to simulate starting an exercise program really quick and fast.
Gotcha.
And they were young. They were, you know, they were undergrads, you know, so they had to like run 3 miles the first day.
A little bit of torture maybe involved.
And they didn't get much out of it other than a free pair of tennis shoes. And then we did all the testing on them that we were able to do at that time.
What kind of tests were they?
Well, they were, boy, this is making me scratch my little science brain here a little bit. But they, like aerobic capacity tests. And then we just did like, you know, skin fold tests, so body fat estimates and, you know, weight and things like that. So we just had idea, like the physical changes in their bodies and their aerobic capacity from this. I don't know how long the study went on. It was several weeks. And then they had to come in for blood draws. So, and then there was a hematologist who was interested in that. That's where and he is the one that helped interpret the lab tests and what ones to do and stuff like that, so that we could figure out what was going on. So
that's really cool.
Yeah,
anatomy and physiology is my favorite.
Yeah.
I'm in AMP 2 this semester.
Oh, fantastic!
Yeah,
I love anatomy and physiology.
Me too.
And oh my gosh, how much do we know now? We didn't know hardly any of this that we know now. It's just amazing what we know now. You know, and the neurobiology, that's just a wide open.
Yeah, kind of. I chose.
Field.
I another reason I chose it was because I also kind of want to be a pioneer. I want to do something new.
Yeah.
You know, like that's
yeah,
another
yeah.
reason why I've chose
yeah.
that field, because it
oh.
seems to, you know, like I just there's so much that we don't know. And
yeah, well, there was a woman, a neurobiologist back in women's studies, Ruth. Can't think of her last name. Maybe I'll think of it later. But other people from this era will remember her.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a neurobiologist. She'd gone to med school, and she was the one that was doing all this research showing that women's brains weren't inferior to men's
mm-hmm.
brains, you know, but it was on a much more gross level,
right?
You know,
right.
Than now. But yeah, so there were lots of, it was a time in history where you could be a pioneer pretty easily.
Yeah.
Because, you
there
know,
was so
things
much
were changing
new...
so rapidly
mm-hmm.
for women.
What know? Do you remember Madison being like? In that time, you know, as
I loved Madison.
Yeah.
You know, I loved the university because there were people from all over the world here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I loved the opportunity to be able to meet and talk with people from all over the world. You know, coming out as a lesbian, it's got to be one of the better places in the world
mm-hmm.
to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, especially, you know, I did get a little involved. Oh, yeah, speaking of bars, there was a bar not too far from the house, Going My Way,
mm-hmm.
was a bar that I actually used to go there to study. I do. You know, and then there was the Lysistrata, the
mm-hmm.
feminist bar. Spent a lot of time there. So just for me as a young white lesbian, it was a very supportive place
mm-hmm.
to come of age, you know.
What do you think about lesbians of color? Do you think, I mean, was that even really a conversation that was going on,
you know,
at
like
the time,
I said, we weren't talking about that much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were some lesbians of color that I knew that I would see places, and, you know, that some of them I'd be friends with for a little while or whatever, you know. But we didn't really talk about race that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our race analysis, it's kind of like, yeah, racism is bad, but we're good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those good white people,
mm-hmm.
not one of those racist white people, you know. So we didn't have much of an analysis at that time.
Mm-hmm.
That came later. You know, all the concepts about white privilege and white supremacy culture and, you know, all that kind of stuff. You know, I would say that my experience in women's studies, you know, and being a lesbian myself, being, and also being gender nonconforming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got, from the time I came to school here, people thought I was a man most of the time. I got carded well into my 30s, I think. Because when people thought I was a man, you know, maybe I looked more like a young boy or something like that to
mm-hmm.
them. So, you know, so I had those things, my experience in women's studies, that learning about that kind of analysis, you know, having a different perspective than the mainstream
mm-hmm.
perspective. And then being on the fire department, that's where I really started developing my analysis around race.
Mm-hmm.
And class, because that was definitely also an issue in
yeah,
the
how
fire
did,
department.
How did class play into
well
the politics of the fire department?
Well, you know, I had a master's degree
right.
by the time I got hired on the fire department, and apparently, even though I consider myself kind of working class culturally,
mm-hmm.
And I could get along to some extent in the fire department because I understood that culture. The fact that I had a master's degree, just people just hated that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people would just say things, well, why don't you ask her? She's got the master's degree. You know, there was a lot of kind of disparagement because a lot of the men who were on the fire department when we got there only had a high school education,
mm-hmm.
you know. And in my class in particular, almost everyone had at least a bachelor's degree. That's including the white men the men of color and all the white women that were hired in that class, mm-hmm. almost all of us had at least an undergraduate degree, and there were two of the women had master's degrees. I was one of them, so a lot of people didn't like that too much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of played out in that respect. I was so glad that I grew up around the Green Bay Packers, because that gave me something to talk to people about at the fire station.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, growing up in a small town in rural Wisconsin actually did come in handy under, you know, I had gone hunting when I was a teenager, you know, so I'd gone deer hunting and all this kind of stuff, and I fished all the time I was growing up. I went fishing with my dad all the time, so, you know, I could share some of those experiences. I go fishing with some of the guys and stuff like that. So it was a way to build some bridges.
Yeah, a way to make a connection with people.
Yeah, so for me, you know, that kind of more working class upbringing helped me survive.
Right.
You know what my biggest coping mechanism was, though?
What's that?
I pretended I was an anthropologist, and I was simply there to study the culture. Because I was so resistant to becoming part of the culture
mm-hmm.
on the fire department, you know.
And that was due to, you know, kind of the...
That was, you know, like, here I was a feminist, you
right,
know.
Right, right.
They called us girls,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I was like, oh, man, I was constantly correcting people and, you know, and it was really hard being a feminist on the fire department, that's
mm-hmm.
for sure. And those of us, it was interesting, those of us who were also out as lesbians... They called us radicals. That was kind of the cold word for lesbian
within the fire
feminists.
Department.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah. The radicals are doing this, or the radicals are the ones that, you know, hide the porn or burn it or whatever. You know. You know. But yeah, that was my biggest coping mechanism was, okay, this is a really different culture.
Right.
And I'm just trying to be curious. I'm here observing, I'm taking
mm-hmm.
notes, I'm trying to understand, you know, and I'm trying to, you know, also hold on to my values and
right,
and
at the same
culture.
Time,
yeah,
yeah.
At the same time.
Was it infuriating sometimes? Did you have days that were harder to be an anthropologist than others?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of times I struggled a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I struggled with my mental health
mm-hmm.
while I was on the job. I mean, it was so stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a chronic disease when I went on the fire department. I lied about it to get in. I had ulcerative colitis.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I had a huge flare when I was going through training. How I ever physically completed training camp, to this day, it's just totally a miracle to me. But I did, and I got better. But I would have flares, you know, when things would get, you know, you get on a certain crew, certain people you didn't get along with that
mm-hmm.
well, or, you know, some individuals, for certain officers, were really difficult to work for,
mm-hmm.
you know, won't even talk to you or tell you what to do, never give you a job to do on the fire scene, you know,
mm-hmm.
you were just kind of like tagging along and, you know, doing whatever you could think of to do, but, you know, they wouldn't give you a task, they wouldn't. You know, they would take your equipment away from, you know, if you had an axe, they'd take it away from you and give it to somebody else and go tell them to do something with it because they forgot. You know, it's like, just stuff like that was just so hard to take on so many levels, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I think, you know, I probably, in looking back, I probably developed fibromyalgia while I was on the fire department. I basically, I left in my mid-40s after almost 20 years. I was having so much chronic pain,
mm-hmm.
you know. Part of that is not sleeping at night.
Yeah.
Years and years and years getting woken up at night, having a, you know, not a consistent sleep schedule, but just that chronic stress
mm-hmm.
of just kind of being on the outside year after year after year and, you know, and trying to make change from within the department. You know, I worked hard at that. Tried all kinds of things, you know, tried to get tough, tried to, you know, argue with people and stand toe-to-toe with them and, you know, kind of adapt the culture, And that didn't work very well for me because that really wasn't who I was, you know, and it was stressful trying to be like that, you know. And, you know, and I realized that, you know, I had made a lot of enemies with my feminism and then my anti-racism that was developing while I was there, you know, calling people out on stuff, you know. So, yeah, I left and became much healthier.
It's a good thing.
Years to follow.
Yeah, I worked third shift for a while, for like 3 years. I know it's nowhere near close to 20, but I think it took a lot out of me.
Yeah,
you know, I worked actually, my first one was at Denny's, and I would work doubles starting in the nighttime, so I'd come in at 8 at night, and I wouldn't leave until 4 the next day.
Oh my gosh.
And so I certainly feel much better, I can only imagine, after almost 20 years of that.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it affects any shift workers or people that work at night and stuff like that.
Yep.
It definitely takes a toll on your health.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do after?
Well, then I went to nursing school, and I got a bachelor's degree in nursing. It took me 2 years because that was, I had already had an undergraduate degree from UW.
Right.
Yeah. And then I worked for a year as an RN, and then I went back to graduate school and got a master's in nursing, and so I've been a nurse practitioner since then, you know. You know, the other thing I failed to mention, and this goes back, this interweaves with the whole feminism and everything, is that I was a lesbian mom back when that was kind of a new thing, too. Back in the 80s, after I got on the fire department, I met a woman at one of these conferences from another fire department who got pregnant with artificial insemination, and had a child, and was a single parent, raising a child as a firefighter.
Wow.
So, oh my gosh, I couldn't stop, you know, talking to her about it. Because it was like I'd always wanted to be a parent, and I'd kind of given up on that as a possibility, being a lesbian, you know. I was just like, you know, kind of hoping something that would happen. You know, that I'd meet a woman who had little kids or something, or, you know, and didn't think about the idea of me actually getting pregnant. So I did get pregnant and had a child, and I was a single parent until I met my current partner for many years. But that, you know, I mean, part of why I even thought I could do that, I think, goes back to my time in women's studies and learning about feminism and, you know, just that, you know, there are all these doors are open to you, you know.
That's so wonderful.
Yeah.
How old is your kid?
She is going to be 27 in April.
What's her name?
Brianna.
Brianna.
Yeah. So, anyways, that's about the best thing I ever did.
Oh. Yeah. My mom's my best friend in the whole entire world. So.
That's great. Yeah. 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 So, anyways.
Is there anything else that you...
I don't know. Is there anything I didn't cover? Feel like I talked a lot. I'm just trying to think about current, you know, kind of like the activism and stuff
that's going on.
I'm an activist now, you know, much more. You know, I've been going to the Young, Gifted, and Black protests whenever, or actions whenever I can. I really... I'm just so excited about this movement they're creating. And I'm also very involved through my congregation. I'm involved in an organization called Moses, which is an interfaith organization working to reduce the prison population in the state of Wisconsin. And basically, more generally, we're putting most of our energy into prison reform. And so it connects right up with some of the things that Young, Gifted, and Black are talking about. You know, we're about the Dane County Jail and all the changes that need to be made here in Dane County and in the city of Madison with respect to policing and incarceration. So, yeah, so it all, you know, just kind of transforms itself over the decades, you know.
Yeah, what do you think about the state of feminism now?
You know, I have to confess, I don't think or read that much about feminism anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I've been actively reading. When I was on the fire department, my experience of race, it was much more like a first-hand kind of experience. I wasn't reading much about it then. It was
mm-hmm.
after I left the fire department that I started getting interested in these, in the concepts that had starting to, you know, be written about more. So I do a lot more reading now. And I tell you, I love reading, like, there are so many good articles that people post on Facebook now.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned so much about, you know, internalized white supremacy and internalized racial inferiority and microaggression, you know, all these concepts. So I like to think much more about just, you know, how all these oppressions intersect and how, especially for me, you know, identifying as a lesbian for so many years. And I just think, you know, for a long time, I really worried about, it was really harder for me to come out to black people, you know, because I thought they weren't going to be as accepting you because
mm-hmm.
Of the stereotypes, you know. And now I just think it's so important to build those bridges, you know, across the different oppressions,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, yeah, I don't read that much about feminism. Once in a while I do, or I read articles. I like, you know, a lot of the stuff that I see that I like to read is often written by women of color feminists, you know. But, you know, I turned out to be more of a working class kind of person and not so academic,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you know, even though I got 2 master's degrees now. A lot of it for me is about relationships and building relationships and just, you know, standing with people
yeah.
in their struggle. And I feel incredibly blessed and privileged. You know, I've got, you know, more than enough of a piece of the pie, you know,
yeah.
to take care of my needs and my family's needs. So I just really, you know, goes back to that idea of service, of giving my time and my money, you know, to help make things more equitable. You know, that's kind of what I'm into.
So when women's studies mm-hmm. was kind of like a catalyst for...
Oh, yeah. It just, yeah, yeah, yeah. It was just so fantastic to have my mind open at that age, you know. To all of that. And I did, it was my college roommates my freshman year, you know, my college roommate and her friends, they went out and bought me Our Bodies, Ourselves, and then they gave me The Feminine Mystique.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first feminist book I read, and it was like, wow, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, you know, it wasn't until then I played sports, and, you know, it just gave me that courage to do those things I wanted to do. But then it was that time of being in women's studies and getting to hear and discuss all these ideas, you know, just really helped shape my analysis, shape my view of the world.
Yeah, it seemed like it gave you courage when you were speaking earlier about how you were intimidated to talk to your professors.
Yeah.
And then you were speaking later about standing toe-to-toe with these firemen.
I know.
You know,
I know. Little old girl from Marion, Wisconsin,
mm-hmm.
standing up to the biggest guy in the fire station and telling him, you know what, you're wrong about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, if there's anything else you feel that you'd like to talk about, you certainly will. But that's
that's all I can think of.
Okay.
So.